This week in Retronauts, forget the boomers' parents. This is the real Greatest Generation. Welcome to Retronauts, the podcast where we say spicy things about old people and video games. I'm your host, Jeremy Parrish, and actually, I'm an old person. I was out of college. I was out of college when the game we're talking about today came out in America. So that's where I'm coming from. Yes, it's the 20-odd-ish anniversary of Pokemon, and as part of our kind of commitment to going into greater depth into classic game topics with the show, we are going to be taking a generation-by-generation look at the Pokemon series. And actually, that's not even including the spin-offs and side games. But there's a lot to be said about the Pokemon games. We've done some cursory examinations of Pokemon in the past. But, you know, a series with this much cultural clout, this much success, this much influence deserves much more than just like an hour and a half of us saying, well, here's how it works. Okay, thanks everyone for enjoying the show. So here we are, traveling back in time, rewinding to revisit Pokemon Generation 1. And I probably mentioned that my name is Jeremy Parrish, but I have not mentioned who is here, the people who are present in the room and on the internet with me to talk about these games. Why don't we start with the newcomer to the show, who is calling in remotely. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Casey DeFritis. I'm calling in all the way from the very sunny and very hot state of Florida, where there are real Pokemon like alligators to see. No, really. You might know me as a late host. I'm still alive, but no longer host of Nintendo Voice Chat at IGN. And I've been doing Pokemon wikis over at IGN since 2016. That's kind of how I got my foot in the door there. So very much a fan of Pokemon, and it's kind of what got me into the gaming realm as I know it.
Well, welcome to the show, and I look forward to your extensive Pokemon knowledge being brought to bear on this episode. And actually, you're going to be in kind of neck and neck contention with another Pokemon expert. Please introduce yourself.
Hey, it's Kat Bailey. I have a long history of talking about Pokemon on this particular program, going back to the early days of Retronauts, where I was talking about the competitive community, to the time that I almost got into a fist fight with Bob over the relative merits of Ruby and Sapphire. I was on IGN's Pokemon boards back in 2003. Talking about the competitive community, I go way back with this series. And my first ever Pokemon was Charmander.
As is only right.
Mine too.
Wow. I'm pretty sure I picked the green one. I always pick the green ones. Although the original, they were all green. Anyway, Shivam. Oh, sorry, I spoiled it. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Shivam Putt. I'm just a frequent, I guess, gadfly guest here on Retronauts. And I was in 11th grade when Pokemon came out. And it took the school by storm. So, and in fact, this morning, just before recording, I was helping my son through his first ever Pokemon run as we're going through Sword and Shield.
Oh my God, and that's amazing.
It is really, there's nothing that ages you like playing a game with your kid that you played when you were a kid.
Oh, I bet.
And it was just, and so, seeing Pokemon through the eyes of a child again has helped bring me back to a mindset that can maybe work this episode out a bit more.
That's great. I don't have kids, and I was not a kid when I played Pokemon for the first time. So I am bringing the alien perspective here. In fact, Generation 1 has kind of a video gaming blind spot for me, because I was very much into following video games and reading the media, reading Imagine Games Network and N64.com about video games. And so I was certainly aware of Pokemon, or Pocket Monsters, as we called it back in the day before it was properly localized. But then I picked up the game when it launched on Game Boy, along with a Game Boy Color that I imported from Japan because I couldn't wait that extra month. And just
imagine having money to be able to import a Game Boy in 1998.
I mean, I didn't have a lot of money, but it was, you know, more than like probably an 11th grader.
Made bad financial decisions.
I had a job that paid very little, but an apartment that cost very little. So it worked out.
I had to borrow a Game Boy and Pokemon to play Game Boy Pokemon. So
I had a job by this time, so I was able to buy a Game Boy Color.
Yeah, my parents were not about to let me do that. That was not happening.
I didn't have a lot of money, but I had a lot of some leftover lunch money that I used to pay for one of those Charmander Burger King toys. Oh. So that's the amount of money I was rolling in. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as the relatively big spender here, I feel a little ashamed here because, you know, I had this opulent wealth of like a 30K a year salary. And just, you know, I bought Pokemon and said, I'm not feeling it. It was really slow.
This will never last.
No, it wasn't that. It was like it. You know, I went into it having been playing RPGs for the better part of a decade.
Well, yeah.
And it just felt very basic and very slow. And the initial, like the kind of the early game loop, really didn't appeal to me. And so I kind of bounced off of it, and didn't really pick up Pokemon until Generation 4 with Diamond and Pearl on DS, and that was where I finally was like, okay, now I'm actually older, like much older, and this is exactly the same game, and yet somehow I like it.
I mean, I didn't really catch the bug until XY. It took me way long to
read. Yeah, you were so out on Pokemon for so long.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have known each other for almost that time.
I thought it was Heart Gold and Soul Silver that really got you.
Yeah, I got that because I was like sitting there and there was a little walker that you could do. Mm-hmm.
You were like, Kat, explain Pokemon to me.
I've done that like four times.
Yeah. But it finally took, right?
Yeah, it did. And after that, I've just been like, oh, I get this and I enjoy this. And now I've been carrying my Pokemon through. But the thing that got me is because when this came out, I was like a junior in high school, like I said. And because I was a world-weary 17-year-old, Pokemon was definitely my first RPG level, you know, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. And the gameplay itself, compared to like the fact that at the same time I'm playing things like Final Fantasy VII or whatever, and I'm looking at this like, it's okay, but all my friends were so hardcore into it, and it's like the same crew that was playing Pogs, that was playing Magic, now we're sitting in the back of the physics class trading Pokemon. But my brother, who is 4 years younger than me, was the dead target demographic for this game. Like, we would come home from school, we would watch the anime together, in, you know, Saturday, whatever, Friday afternoons or something, and he had a big, gigantic, plush, not Bulbasaur, who's the blue one?
Squirtle.
Squirtle. Yeah, he had a big, gigantic, plush Squirtle, and he was like, you know, 12 or 13 or some young enough that plushies were still okay, and it was just like, we would watch this thing and watch like them eating badly localized rice balls as jelly donuts. And I was like,
I always wrap my jelly donuts in seaweed.
Right? It's like, come on, you could see, I've never seen a jelly donut with a black wrapper before. But the thing is, the Pokemon anime lied. Because the Pokemon anime had these guys with amazingly cool Pokemon, and then you turn on the game and you're catching stupid birds and caterpillars. It's like, what is this garbage? Where's the cool Pokemon?
Ash's first Pokemon that he catches besides Pikachu are also stupid birds and caterpillars.
Yeah,
so
but Ash has the benefit of going and having the greatest duel in history where him and that other guy are sitting there yelling, Harden! Harden! To the big phallic-looking box of, like, you know, Metapods at each other.
I disagree.
But the target audience didn't get it.
I disagree, Shivam. Like, Ash barely even evolves most of his Pokemon in the anime.
Yeah,
whereas in the game, you're catching, though, like, the most ultimate legendaries ever.
Like, hey, I just captured God.
Yeah.
Can he evolve?
This is not Gen 1 related, but the most recent, well, kind of. So the most recent Pokemon anime is, the base is in Kanto, and they do have a character named Go, and his goal is to catch them all, and they do catch some pretty cool Pokemon.
I've been watching it with my son. It's weird going back. It's weird. Yeah.
So, Casey, you mentioned that you had enough money that you scrounged together by, you know, saving your pennies at lunch to buy a Charmander toy. Did you actually have Pokemon Gen 1 at the time that it came out, or was that something that you played later? Like, how did you get into Pokemon?
Yeah, so I was the target demographic of Pokemon. I was 7 or 8. I remember the first time I heard about it was at...
Sorry, I just turned to dust. I apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I reformed myself. Okay, I'm back. I did the Benjamin Button thing and aged instantly. Okay, so you were 7 or 8.
I was 7 or 8. I must have been in the second grade, I think.
Jesus.
And I went to an after school program, and I remember sitting there under a tree on the floor, because that's what kids do. We weren't allowed chairs because no one respects children. And my friends were telling me about this new thing called Pokemon, and I had to go see it. Like, how have I not seen this new cartoon? It's the best thing ever. So I asked my parents to take me to Blockbuster so I could get this new show. So it must have been after it had started airing, but not that much later, because like I said, I was in the second grade, and that must have been like, I don't know, 1998. So I went to Blockbuster, and I remember there being just walls and walls of Pokemon I Choose You DVD, just complete walls. That's how popular this was, that Blockbuster dedicated an entire corner of the store to just that one DVD for Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it clicked. I think about it now, like, why would I have watched that and loved it so much as a kid? And it just did. And I begged for a Game Boy Color. I had had a Super Nintendo before that, and I had a Sega Genesis, so I wasn't alien to video games. But, you know, all of my friends had Game Boys, and everyone was playing Pokemon. And I had to play Pokemon, too, because I loved the show so much. And I just got really into it. I would wake up early on Saturday mornings to watch it. And when it started airing after school, I would do that as well. That after school program, when we were there over the summer, they would actually turn on Pokemon for us to watch while we were at aftercare. And otherwise, we were not allowed to watch TV. And it was a privilege. And if anyone acted up, we were not allowed to watch Pokemon that day. So they definitely controlled us with Pokemon. And it worked. It 100% worked. And we had, it kind of was an interesting aftercare. It's called Tanglewood down in Florida. And we decorated a room with a bunch of duplicate Pokemon cards. Oh. I don't know. I was obsessed.
In hindsight, those room decorations were probably worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Absolutely. Who knows how many first editions we had there? No,
Charizard. Oh, wow.
Wow.
Wow. No words anymore. There's my holofoil Charizard.
Oh, my God, dude. If you have a holofoil Charizard, I don't care if you were in second grade. You're not pasting that on the wall.
The holofoil Charizard was a big deal in 1999. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
a big deal in 2099. Yeah.
See, this is why I need all of you here to kind of school me in the actual culture of Pokemon.
It's weird because my son has started picking up Pokemon the card game as well. Not necessarily because he's 7. So he's right in this window of Pokemania, right? So, like, we get the cards. He just wants to trade the cards with a friend simply for the purpose of, I guess, trading cards. But also, we sit and play the game, and he's like, I have a VMAX Crash. I'm like, okay, I don't know. Like, I've been playing card games for 25 years or something, and he's just spewing crap at me, and I'm like, I feel so old. But it's wild to me that Pokemon has both survived as a game, a card game, of anime vehicle, and as, like, just a cultural artifact for this entire span, to the point that it is just like a permanent fixture in the landscape. And I think it's part of going back to, like, the idea that Nintendo, I think Shigeru Miyamoto once said, there are always new kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Pokemon is always your first RPG or your first mm-hmm. card game or your first exposure to a cartoon with continuity or something like that. And I'm watching my own son go through these same, like, cycles of understanding and developing, like, oh, I can get this card. It's got a Tyranitar on it. Oh, wait, I can build this deck around this Tyranitar. And, oh, I can expand outwards. And you see these kind of connections being made and these, like, linkages coming together. And as he sits there, like, today we were playing against in the Dragon Gym or something. And he's like, why are all my guys dying? And he made me go and print out a chart with all of the weaknesses on it. And we sat there and we were like, okay, what beats dragon type? And we sat and we actually looked through his Pokemon garbage pile that he's got, figured out which ones we need. Like, you know, he's not
They're
collecting
not garbage
them all.
They're your friend, unless okay. it's the actual garbage pile.
Yeah, like, you know, rubbish. No, but we were sitting there like, okay, well, we need to get some ice Pokemon. So we ran out and we ground up and got ice Pokemon to come back and fight this thing. And it's just such an educational experience to watch somebody learning and making connections and actually thinking second level strategy underneath just, oh, I've got Joltik because it's furry and cute. And like, that's great, but then you're going to get your ass kicked and you need to actually start thinking about how do I win? And Pokemon is a really fantastic way for you to be able to build that bridge up into going beyond the surface level, wow, this is cute, and into the strategic level of where you're like, oh, I don't care what my armor is because it gives me the best stats that will help me win. Because, like, if you look at your Elite Four teams or your teams that you're taking to the end of the game, they're always just like, maybe there's your one Pokemon that's your favorite, and then there's a bunch of just stat monsters.
Because you have a six Pokemon party, you have the room to include your favorite.
Yeah.
You know, like, you look at Etrian Odyssey, and you have five characters because they feel like the developers felt like five different characters in an RPG party is just enough to make you capable, but always missing something. So you can fill that sixth slot in Pokemon with either something very useful, or you could do like me, and once you capture a Tropius, always have Tropius with you, even though it's garbage because it's flying and grass and therefore vulnerable to basically like everything. Like, anything will kill Tropius in a glance. But it's a dinosaur whose wings are palm tree fronds, and it has bananas for a beard. And I don't really care about game strategy. I need my banana beard dinosaur tree to hang out with me and be my pal.
Look, it just helps that my favorite Pokemon is Blaziken, and Blaziken is also amazing. So, like, you can't go wrong with Kung Fu Chicken. I'm sorry, just that's my boy.
That's the beauty of Pokemon, though, is that on the one hand, it supports all levels, right? I mean, it supports just catching mean Pokemon, doing whatever. You can have a great time. You can just catch them all. You can go high-level competitive strategy. That's why I think there's been... People have tried to mimic the Pokemon formula many times over the years, maybe most recently with Yo-Kai Watch. And these games have found popularity, but they have never found lasting popularity because it's about much more than the merch. These games go very deep. Actually, Pokemon, I would contend, is the kind of the pioneer of social gaming as we know it today. Games as a service.
Absolutely.
Back in the days of 1998-99 with the original Pokemon, the connectivity, the social elements, the battling, the getting to know people, the downloadable content, that was all stuff in Pokemon long before we ever got to Genshin Impact.
Oh, yeah. You used to be able to go to a store and plug in and get a new Pokemon.
You go to Toys R Us. I mean, the whole point was the social elements.
When I was a kid, I mean, that was the game, and both the video game and the card game that people were playing and talking about and interacting with each other for around the play yard or the playground or whatever. And it made people approach others that you otherwise wouldn't. Like, if I saw someone with a Game Boy and I saw that they were playing Pokemon, I would challenge them to a battle. And then I would use my Charizard and spam Fire Spin and win. And then... You know, I got a reputation of being cool, so.
You know, one thing I really respect about Game Freak and Nintendo and the Pokemon Company, etc., is that they've resisted the calls and the demands to change how Pokemon works. You know, as each generation that discovers Pokemon as a kid grows up, they're like, I want these games to grow up with me. These need to take on a harder edge. They need to, you know, be cool and tough and serious. And they need to, you know, change the formula, change how they work. And with each new generation, the Game Freak is just like, No, it's going to be the same thing, but, you know, with new starters, new Pokemon to find in a new region, there'll be some new mechanics, but it's still pretty much the same game that we made, you know, in 1996. And, you know, you do have kind of some forays into other genres and styles, and, you know, they kind of mix things up a little bit by having sort of the mainline games and then the games that are kind of like mainline games but different, like, you know, Let's Go Eevee or something. Mm-hmm. But they really, you know, they really hold true to the idea that this is going to be someone's first video game, someone's first RPG. Let's keep it approachable. Let's, you know, take that grassroots approach. And the funny thing is that I feel like most people who grew up playing Pokemon as kids and outgrew it and were like, it's not cool anymore, you know, three generations later, they come back and they're like, oh man, I love this as a kid. I'm going to play it. Oh, now I have to buy like all the original Game Boy games. And now they're like $300 each because, you know, even though they made 8 million copies of them, more than 8 million people want them. And therefore, mm-hmm. like those old video games that you can buy, you know, on 3DS Virtual Console for like $3, they, you know, people still want the original cartridges to recapture that experience.
And you know, looking to see back some specifically, used kids, you know, like Bulbasaur named Timmy in there, and you're like, yeah,
that's something you can't get on Virtual Console, is like the proof that someone else played this and loved it, and they had their animal friends, their Pokemon friends. But you know, looking back at Generation 1 specifically, the series, the games we're talking about this episode, those came into existence in like a very specific crucible, like petri dish of circumstances that could never exist again. Like, you know, by 1996 and 98 in the US, Game Boy was like, it was pretty much on the outs. No one really cared about it.
Yeah.
But they were everywhere. Everyone had a Game Boy. They were just like, you know, sitting in desk drawers around, you know, just somewhere in the background. And suddenly this game came out that everyone wanted to socialize and play together. And it was all about trading and getting together with friends. So people dusted off those old Game Boys and scraped out the battery corrosion and whatever. And, you know, like they had the means.
My Game Boy.
They had the means to play this game. And so it was like this immediate pickup and play groundswell. And no one else was doing portable games at the time. There were no competitors to Nintendo at the time these games came out. It was like no one cared about portable games. And even Nintendo was kind of like, eh. But this sparked, you know, a revival for the entire format of gaming.
Yeah, Game Gear was dead, Lynx was dead, and nobody was particularly pursuing portable gaming, as you were already saying. If you want to go back to kind of the defining interview, I think, for Pokemon, Arino from Game Center CX did a big interview with Satoshi Tajiri back in 2003, and it's fascinating to see him talk about that particular era and how they all eventually came around to working with Nintendo. Because, I mean, he was a programmer. He got to know Nintendo through them. He won contests, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And eventually came around to pitching his idea for Pokemon. When, like, Nintendo was putting out calls for pitches for games.
And can you imagine, like, Nintendo asking for pitches?
They were like, no, they were like, yeah, somebody told Tajiri, yeah, if you want to pitch a game, now's the time, because Nintendo's like looking for new ideas. And he's like, here's my idea. And they're like, all right, we'll buy your pitch. And that's basically how Pokemon came around. It's fascinating how like you could get your foot in the door at this time.
It's so wild.
Yeah.
Is Pokemon Company independent of Nintendo?
Yes.
That's insane to think about. You would think that Nintendo would have just bought them by now.
So they're an independent company.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird amalgamation of Game Freak, the Pokemon Company, and Nintendo together.
And also Creatures.
And yeah. Creatures, yes. And Creatures does focus on the card creation more so than the games. They also do art for the games.
Yeah, people don't really understand the Pokemon ecosystem. The Pokemon Company International is kind of the marketing merchandise arm. Mm-hmm. Game Freak, they make the actual games, but the they also games. Outsource.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then Creatures is sort of a support studio that also works on the card games.
It does a lot with licensing based around characters and goods, right? Like merchandise.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Casey, correct me if I'm wrong, back in the, was it Sonority Genius or something like that? They worked on Colosseum back in the day, and they were kind of a spin-off from Game Freak. Genius Sonority.
Genius Sonority, yeah.
That's the one.
Jeez.
I think so. Didn't they work on Dragon Quest a little bit as well before?
They were doing ports. Like, they were also acting as kind of a support studio for Game Freak back in the early 2000s. Yeah.
Okay. I forgot they existed, to be totally honest.
Yeah, me too. Honestly, they weren't very good.
Going back, I like Coliseum, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, going back to like 1996, 97, when that game first hit America's thing.
That was 98.
When it first got here in America, the thing that blew my mind, and I think the thing that really captured a lot of us, was that the link cable was like the first time we'd really seen active use all the time of people with link cables
since
and Game Boy.
Tetris.
Yeah, I mean, there was Tetris, but I didn't see many people playing competitive Tetris. Mm. Not the way of, like, we weren't walking around school with link cables when Tetris was a thing.
No.
But when Game Boy, and I mean, when Pokemon was a thing, you would see people with their, like, Game Boy Pockets or their Game Boys sitting there, sitting underneath the trees or in the quad or whatever, like, 3 feet away from each other, just jamming games. And it was wild. Like, the first time you would transfer a Pokemon and you see the little egg thing coming over, and it's just... It was so cool. It was so cool to be able to, like, digitally trade something.
For us, it was the link cable stretching across the aisle on the bus.
That sounds safe.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever take advantage of children playing playing Pokemon? Because
That's mean.
No.
I was taking advantage of so much. so many. It's okay. I like to kind of logically... explain it. For example, it's like, oh, because you could only get, I think, what, like one or two Snorlax in the entire game?
Yeah. And, well, just one.
Yeah, just one. And so where Scyther is difficult to catch, you can catch multiple of them in the Safari Zone. And I was tricked into trading my Snorlax for a Scyther.
No.
And so, but the thing is, I was trying to fill out my Pokedex, and as long as I had owned it at one point, it would count as filling it out.
Yeah.
So they traded it, and then they laughed at me and were like, haha, you were tricked. You can only get one Snorlax in the game. And it's like, well, like, it's not like I was going to use it, but
yeah, like, nobody,
why would someone more purposely try to trick me like that?
That's,
man,
so mean. I think that I do have a recollection of, like, I don't even remember why, but I encountered some first grader, maybe very young children, who were playing Pokemon, and they're like, we'll battle you. And I'm like, okay, I guess. And those little monsters had freaking a team full of Mewtwo's. Oh, I was like, how did you do that? Jerk.
Game Shark kids.
Get wrecked, lady.
Yeah, I got wrecked.
I encountered some children who cheated at a Pokemon World Championships as well.
Whoa.
Oh, man. The first few years of Pokemon, like, World Championships and, like, the card game stuff were just so full of, like, scammers and cheaters and people just exploiting the hell out of this game.
Uh-huh.
It was not the tightest design, this original Pokemon game.
No. And that's something that I think is actually worth talking about, is just how this game came into being. And the slow and somewhat tortured development process. I don't know how much everyone knows about Game Freak before Pokemon, but...
I know that they were basically an enthusiast collective that did magazines.
Yeah, they started publishing fanzines in like 1982. So that would have been around, you know, that was before Nintendo had a console. That was back when they were just writing about PC games at the time.
Yeah.
Or I guess maybe they were writing about like Epic Cassette Vision, but...
And Tajiri was very much of that generation of Japanese developers who spent a lot of time in arcades, was heavily influenced by games like Xevious and that kind of thing, Space Invaders.
I keep telling everyone Xevious is like the most influential game no one cares about in America, but any developer interview you see from someone from that generation, like,
absolutely.
I was just editing an interview with Yuzo Koshiro, and he's like, when I saw news that that was coming to Famicom, I like cried. I was so ecstatic. Like, it just was the greatest moment of my life. Like, just, you know, it was so influential. But yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to get off on a sidebar, but there is like these common touchstones for a generation of developers.
That was a big one. And I'm forgetting the name of the mall that has all of the retro shops in Japan, but it's not Akihabara.
Nakano,
yeah. You can find old Game Freak fanzines there and like actually buy them today.
That's so wild. 1982 was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It was. So, I was there.
I was one.
I was not alive at this time, but Tajiri was a programmer and a hardcore gaming enthusiast slash hobbyist who managed to turn what he loved into a full-time job.
Yeah, but it took him like 82, 92, like 15 years to get around to doing that. I mean, well, that's a lot of...
Game Freak established itself as a game developer in 1989, and they published some games for NES, Famicom. They made some games for Genesis. They made Pulse Man. But the Pokemon concept came around in like 89, 90, like right at the beginning of the studio, and they worked on it in the background for like 6 years. And they took all these other jobs, they've said, you know, as kind of like contract gigs just to sort of keep the lights on. But the whole time they were just plugging away at this game. But that's a long time to work on a game. And, you know, data integrity was not the greatest back then. So I think that's a big part of why it's such like the very first generation, Red and Green in Japan in, you know, early 1996 were such a mess, because it was just like this thing that they kept contributing to, and then they'd lose data. Like they worked on this workstation that wiped out all their data, and they had to come up with some sort of recovery plan to get the information back or lose everything. And you know, so much happens over that time when they're working in the background. Like, and it was so full of ideas. Like, if you know what the limitations of the Game Boy are, the fact that they crammed so much into this game, by far, like, no Game Boy game had this much content or material and variety and multiplayer and competitive play, you know, just, like, so much stuff to do.
Was the EV-IV stuff in the first game?
No, it was different at that time, yeah. The EV-IV stuff would come into Ruby and Sapphire. Now, there was a basic version of how these stats would make. And maybe Casey can explain it a little more clearly. But the way that it handled stats in Red and Gold, once it came out on 3DS, you could transfer your Pokemon from Pokemon, the original Red, into Pokemon Home or whatever, and into the more modern games. And the modern games would automatically translate the stats from those games into the more modern version.
And one of the reasons for that as well is because if you look back at Gen 1, Special was only one stat. So in the newer generations, we have Special Attack and Special Defense, and back then it was only one. And also back then, you didn't have special attacks and physical attacks. So for example, like Flare Blitz uses a Pokemon's physical attack stat and Flamethrower uses a special attack stat. If it was fire, it only used special regardless. So some Pokemon were just screwed. So it kind of made it a little bit unbalanced because of that reason.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Diamond and Pearl that the physical special split would come around.
The game does not do a good job of teaching you this inside the game.
Oh, no, not at all.
Like, there is no way to determine what is a... like, my son asks me all the time, like, we got an SP boost. What does that mean? And I'm like, beats the hell out of me, kid. Like,
but that was the magic of it, right? Because there were so many mechanics. And so you just naturally wanted to learn more about it as you got more and more hooked on the game. And so you would find all these resources and it would teach you all about it. But Game Freak specifically went out of their way to obfuscate the mechanics, especially in the early days, because they did not want you to think about these Pokemon in mechanical terms. They wanted you to think of them as real living creatures that could be randomized in interesting ways, and so that was what the mechanics were much more about. But of course, horrible competitive players like myself would min-max the hell out of them.
Oh, yeah. You end up with things like, oh, this horse has got, like, you know, 38 EV and, like, attacks you with dark Tauna. It's like, what? What did you do? I like this guy because it's a fuzzy cotton ball with eyes.
You play Final Fantasy Tactics, for God's sake.
Okay, yeah, I understand. Look, I understand that. I'm just taking the role here of ye old curmudgeonly guy who wants to catch a cute thing.
Sure. But you can do that in Pokemon.
I know. Until you get to, like, the Elite Four, and then you're like, okay, now it's time for you to actually play.
You should just play like me, and always have a Love Disc, and always have a Spinda in your party. Because who cares?
Endotropius? If they're any, that's
Endotropius,
half your team.
Yes.
That's the power trio right there. That's all that matters. Yeah, I mean, you can definitely do like Kat and have your spreadsheets and spend laborious months creating the perfect Pokemon. Or you can just, you know, play because...
Bicycling back and forth.
I mean, like this character that I saw in the cartoon, and I want to beat other monsters up with it.
I treat Pokemon a little like I play Skyrim. These days, Like in Skyrim, it's all about my werewolf girlfriend and my my mansion in the capital. In Pokemon, it's like my only goal is to catch all of the legendaries. That is my goal. So like, you can create your own
attack
objectives.
Attack and throne and capture God.
Yeah, you can create your own objectives in Pokemon. You could be a hardcore competitive. I don't have time for that anymore.
No.
I don't have time to catch all 800, I think, at this
moment. No, it's 900.
900?
Yeah. I think there is officially 1,000 Pokemon now.
Are we at 1,000?
Has
it happened?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's insane. Okay, I don't have time for that. I only catch the legends, and I have like kind of my trophy cabinet, and I'm like, that's good. And I'm happy. Pokemon lets you do that.
Yeah, the cool thing is Pokemon can be played either way. You can mm-hmm. be super serious or just super casual. You can be super competitive. You can just play through the story mode on your own. It really doesn't matter. It's very open in that sense.
Yeah. And I mean, because I remember some of our earlier conversations, Kat, where you were telling me about you being the genocidal tyrant who is out there, like, you know, just breeding these people for their stock.
And, yeah. Right. I photoshopped what was No Man's Land from World War I, but I had, like, Beedoofs. Like, there's a Fearow flying overhead. The Beedoofs are all dead. Yes.
It's wild to me, though.
By the way, I lied. It's not. It's not 1,000. I knew we had just hit a milestone, but the milestone was over 900.
I'm sorry, my glass just broke.
That's 1/10 of a Dragon Ball meme.
But when you look back at Pokemon Gen 1, though, graphically, the game is real kind of garbo. Very simple, very line drawing-y. It's like, but it's effective enough for, and at the time when you're looking at Game Boy games, we're not talking like big expressive art here. So they managed to get a lot of character into these Pokemon, despite having very little real estate and only effectively line drawings to work with, right? Like, there's no real shading to speak of. I mean,
there's two levels of shading for each Pokemon.
Fine, but it still looked
super... And what's amazing is the American version that came out was actually an enhanced version of the original launch, because mm-hmm. Pokemon Red and Green had, like, much more basic art.
I love the sprites in Pokemon Red and Green, especially Fat Pikachu. Weird. He's so cute.
Fat,
I just want to pinch his little cheeks and get electrocuted. But the crazy thing about the first generation of Pokemon is that the two kind of lead minds there, Ken Sugimori and Satoshi Tajiri, were the original founders of Game mm-hmm. Freak, the kind of game designer and the illustrator. And like Sugimori's art is all like that's what you see in the first generation game.
I think Sugimori isn't used as much anymore, but I like Sugimori's art.
His art is great.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
A lot more than current art.
I mean,
I'm
the
being
Gen
honest.
1 Pokemon were iconic and like still recognizable. Like Pikachu is like Mickey Mouse level, like universally yeah. recognized, you know.
In Japan for sure. Like the last time I was in Japan, Pikachu was everywhere. Like Pikachu hawking soccer teams over there, yeah. Like on promo nights.
Yeah, I mean, you go to the Pokemon store there, and they always have someone in a like Pikachu of the month costume. Like,
uh-huh.
This month, it's Pilot Pikachu, and he or she is walking around shaking children's hands for every like once an hour for every, you know, for 2 minutes.
Every mm-hmm. it's every Pokemon Center and every location in Japan also has a particular mascot for that city or location, which is just. Adds even more characterization. And I know you guys were just talking about how they fit so much character into the game, but you have to remember there were so many companion pieces of media that went with the game that I think helped kids really connect to it and expand their imagination. I mean, we not only had the game and the anime, we also had like coloring books and we had comic books and we had the guides that had the full illustrations and stickers, and we had so many things to connect to the game that it allowed us to very easily see more than what was there.
I think a big part of what makes Pokemon so endearing is the fact that Satoshi Tajiri didn't sit down to create a game that would be a hit. He wanted to create a game that just expressed two things that he loved, video games, or combined two things that he loves, video games and collecting bugs and you know, doing the beetle battles.
I was going to say that sarcastically, but it's true.
It is true.
Japan loves catching bugs.
I'm the bug professor.
Japan has the coolest beetles. They're like a foot long. No, okay, they're not that long, but they're like several inches. You know, in size, they're huge, and they have like these, you know, stag beetle horns, and like they're just terrifying looking but pretty benign, so kids would capture them and make them fight. It's kind of horrible, but you know, it's what kids do, and like that is pretty much what Pokemon is.
Are we gonna get into the ethics of Pokemon?
Satoshi Tajiri wanted to be an entomologist, which is a scientist that studies insects, and you get some of that information as well. I mean, they would catch the bugs and then also make them fight each other, specifically the beetles, as you were all mentioning. So I think Heracross is the most accurate Pokemon from what they were basing it on, right?
Yeah, and if you look at the original Pokemon and kind of when it was conceived, 1990-ish, it really combines a lot of things that were happening at the time. You know, like that was kind of at the peak of Dragon Quest mania. Dragon Quest III had just come out in Japan. Ooh. And was like, you know, that was the game that everyone lined up to play and to buy. So, you know, naturally this game takes the form of an RPG. It's got the competitive element because Game Boy had just launched and it had the link cable. And then, you know, the original name for this was Capsule Monsters. And the idea there seems very similar in concept to Dragon Ball's Capsule Corporation. Capcore. Where, you know, basically they had this technology that you could pop out a little tiny pill capsule and
turn it into all sorts of things.
Yeah, anything could come out of it. And that was a kind of concept that goes back in Japanese pop media to at least the 60s. I've been watching Ultra 7 recently. Mm-hmm. And even though it's like an Ultraman spinoff and it's about a guy who turns into a red and silver giant robot thing, like his other ability is that he has this belt full of little capsules, and he'll toss out the capsule and some sort of monster will come out and fight a kaiju for him.
Yes.
And that's pretty much Pokemon right there. So it's like all these things that were huge and influential and popular in Japan kind of being funneled together into Tajiri's love of collecting bugs and battling bugs and his love of programming video games. And you come out with this thing that is a synthesis of a lot of different influences, but all of them just feel inspired from a pure place, as opposed to, you know, hey, you know, we've got to make a video game. We've got to hit our schedule production deadline. No, they spent since 6 years making this thing because it was just like a passion project and a really like personal sort of vision, I think.
And it was a very collaborative spirit to it, I think. I mean, a lot of game projects, of course, are collaborative, but when you think about how they came up with the Pokemon, right? Everybody basically just submitted their favorite ideas, and then they all voted on them, and that's how they got the original 151, and then they went and drew them, you know? Like, that was their process at that time.
I also just wanted to mention back on the original name for Pokemon as well, like Capsule Monsters, that I'm so glad they had a hard time trademarking Capsule Monsters. I'm not entirely sure why they had a hard time with it, but I know that the Gachapon machines over in Japan, they use capsules and they kind of look like Pokeballs. So that idea would have been really easy to grasp from people from Japan or from people who were used to having machines like that and have such a forefront in the culture. But over here, I think we would have heard Capsule Monsters and maybe would have not gotten it.
Yeah, because in America, capsule is the thing that your medicine comes in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I didn't think hear capsule and think of anything. If anything, because I watched Dragon Ball, I was familiar with Capsule Core, but that was largely not a Western term or idea.
And they might have also thought about the portmanteau and the fact that it would have sounded a little too close to, like, Capcom if you said Capmon instead, you know? And probably Nintendo was like, hey, you're carrying this in your pocket. Maybe it's a pocket monster.
Of course, that created its own complication when it first came to the U.S. because Konami Monster had created NES game based on a toy line called Monster in My Pocket. So when they first started talking about, you know, posting stuff about pocket monsters on IGN or N64.com or whatever, I was like, wait, is this that Konami game? But it wasn't. It was something totally different.
It confused me, too. People were like, I started to hear rumors about Pokemon circa 1997, 98, I want to say. Like, Pokemon, it's the big thing. Pocket monsters is what they were
calling
it.
Kids are having seizures.
People are going crazy with pocket monsters. And I'm like, why is everybody so nuts for Monster in My Pocket? That's not a good game. What are you talking about here?
You know, it was next generation. Everything was getting a 3D facelift. Why not Monster in My Pocket?
I had never heard of that game.
I mean, there's a reason for that. It's because it's not notable.
Right, yeah. It wasn't a good game.
No, it's not at all. It's only memorable because of this, frankly. Mm-hmm. But Pokemon, the name, has rhythm to it, even though back in the 90s it was like Pokemon or Pokemon or whatever.
Pokemon.
And it's just like, it's got a bounce to it. It lends itself to a lot of cool...
South Park famously made it a dirty Japanese word with their whole thing.
I mean, my first memory of it is still hearing like the news reports of kids getting seizures from Pikachu.
Oh, so you heard about that?
Yeah, it was...
Okay. I did not hear about that beforehand. I only heard about it because of, you know, of course, once I got into the fandom, that became a... Oh, yeah, here are like the banned episodes. Like, there's the seizure episode. There's the one where Jesse or James has boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To win a bikini contest,
like that. The anime took a lot of liberties that you would not expect for a game for a 6-year-old. I mean, it was just ingenious to make a kid's RPG at this time, because, like, all the teens who had Game Boys are giving their Game Boys to their kid sisters and kid brothers anyways, and so now these kids have something to play on it, and they can go to elementary school and trade with each other, and then go home and cry about the fact that somebody stole their Ekans or whatever.
And then the Game Boy Color came out in early 1999, I want to say.
No, late 98.
Right on time Pokemon.
Yeah. And that actually secures that solidifies my timeline. I got a Game Boy Color and got into Pokemon in fall of 1998.
There you go.
Game Boy Pocket was out at this time, though, right?
Yeah. That was Game Boy Pocket launched about 4 months after Pokemon launched in Japan. So, you know, I'm sure if Game Freak had their way, they would have launched Pokemon in Japan and the US much, much sooner than they did. Like, it's wild to think that they conceived the game and started working on it when the Game Boy was brand new. And by the time it actually came out, the Game Boy was basically like at the tail end of its life. I mean, Nintendo had already launched a successor of sorts with Virtual Boy. That flopped. But they were working on Project Atlantis, the 32-bit system that was eventually tabled, I think, because of Pokemon's success and the fact that they could just keep selling Game Boys. They didn't need to come up with a successor and, you know, turn that into Game Boy Advance and launched it 5 years later. But, you know, I looked up the numbers. In 1992, Game Boy peaked in Japan. There were 115 releases for the system in 92. That's like more than two every week. And, you know, they were clustered probably around the holidays. But by 1995, the release list had dropped down 50% to just 58 releases that year. And if you look at 96, it's even fewer. And almost all of those are like at the end of the year, I think, once people were like, whoa, people are playing Pokemon. Let's
make
a game.
Nobody was thinking about the Game Boy in 1996 in
America. I mean, 32-bit consoles had just come out. The N64 was just in the wings. It was supposed to have been out already. It was going to happen anytime now. You know, Game Boy Pocket came out, and that kind of helped because it, you know, was smaller. And for the first time, you could see the Game Boy screen, which was nice. But... you know, it was still
a kind of machine.
It was past its prime, really. The system was, and like releasing a game that was kind of the future of this small developer, that was a huge risk. And not only that, but by the time it launched, like the idea of capturing monsters and have them fight alongside you, you know, that was novel in 1990. But by 1996, you had Shin Megami Tensei, where you're capturing demons and they'd fight alongside you. You had Dragon Quest V, where monsters would just be like, hey, I want to fight alongside you. Like, it was no longer a novel concept. By every standard, this game should have been a tremendous failure. It should have just died.
It was not a novel concept in Japan. In America, we were 1 year removed from the launch of Final Fantasy VII, and RPGs were still, console RPGs were still kind of a new concept for a lot of Americans.
We were in the RPG ghetto at that time.
Yeah.
Like, it was not a good time for story games. I mean, like, I was still playing Phantasy Star 4 at the time on the Genesis, or, you know, like, we were in that weird window where, like, people who were hardcore were playing things like Suikoden, maybe, or, like, other early PS1 RPGs, but culturally, we were not there.
We were playing... They managed to turn a game that was functionally an online-enabled Dragon Quest into a mega hit in America. Think about that.
I mean, it's wild to think that, like, Pokemon, the first gen of games, A, it's a shadow RPG in an era where there's no RPGs. B, it's about catching monsters, which is, like, you know, that's cool, Ghostbusters and stuff, but America didn't have a culture of bug catching the way that Japan does. And we didn't have a culture of gotta catch them all the way that... Like, you know, except for
capitalism, man.
And also dogfighting and cockfighting, totally illegal here.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Casey.
You know, I know I just said no to, like, we didn't have a culture of catching bugs and everything. But when I was a little kid, I mean, that's what I did. I would go and catch critters.
Mm. Right. But, like, I mean, like, not
nationwide. But not like that. Yeah. It wasn't a culture thing. It was a couple of weird children did that thing. So,
yeah, I mean,
I understand.
Like, if you're out in the rural areas growing up and catching fireflies in, like, jars and stuff, yeah, that's, I mean, but we were not doing that in, like, the streets of Worcester, Massachusetts, or in San Francisco. They managed to take these cultural concepts, translate them into this incredibly, like, competitive, like, because we were competing about Pokedex with our friends, trying to be like, who can get the 151 first, who can catch the coolest ones, or, you know, like, that whole, like, who was the first one to get, like, a Dratini, or evolve your Eevee into all three things, you know? And they managed to find this, like, exact window where there was nothing else going on, and this just exploded.
And then the anime.
Yeah, releasing the anime, like, kind of pseudo side-by-side with the game was just genius, because that was right at the beginning of the real anime lift of America.
Yeah, Dragon Ball, Pokemon,
like, we had, like,
Toonami.
We had had Sailor Moon and Ronin Warriors leading into Dragon Ball, and then, yeah, like, Toonami wasn't quite there, but we still had, like, you
know. That was, like, 99.
Yeah, we were still getting, like, a lot of, like, inroads into, like, afternoon culture, and then Pokemon showing up right on, like, Fox in, like, 2:30 in the afternoon after school, boom, explosive.
And it was amazing because it, in addition to tying into the games, it had continuity. It was an adventure you wanted to follow each episode. And even though I was probably aged out of the Pokemon anime, the fact that it had continuity at that time made me want to watch week
to week. And you know
what
else they did that was smart? They put it back-to-back with Power Rangers, which was super hype at the time. So, like, going from...
In 98?
It was still popular.
It was, for, like, the kids, like, who were in... For my brother's generation, yeah, it was still, like, popping. I mean, for me, it was, like, I guess a third or fourth gen of Power Rangers at the time. But it was still had enough cultural cachet to be able to lead in and grab people. And I don't know, man. Okay. They just found that window and ran through it, and it was amazing.
It was the anime that caused me to discover the game, because somebody's like, "Yeah, you got to go check out Pokemon. It's great, actually, surprisingly." And then
it still holds up.
Yeah, it's the season one still holds up. Before Ash became an ageless 10-year-old, doomed to wander the earth.
Poor Ash. So we should talk about the games, but first we are going to take a music break to create a nice clean divide. A lot
about the culture around Pokemon and kind of talked about the games, but not in a concrete way. And I think, you know, to make this a proper deep dive, we should discuss exactly how Pokemon works. So looking back to February 1996, you have Pocket Monsters, Red Version and Green Version, or I guess Aka and Midori, if you want to be all like...
Don't be that guy.
Don't, yeah, yeah. Like the guy that I... Never mind, okay. Yes, I don't want to be that guy. So we're talking about Red Version and Green Version, which are very similar to Red and Blue, but not the same. And this is where we talk about how Pokemon works. So how does it work?
It is a RPG where you catch them all. And so, just recently, somebody asked, like, what was the moment that you were hooked into your favorite game? Because Pokemon is a formative game for me, actually. It is one of the games that made me truly fall in love with RPGs, but also a sliding doors kind of moment in my life. Because it was Pokemon that got me into, like, an online community of Pokemon people, which got me to come to, like, kind of delve more into, like, being queer and having that kind of
Pokemon
thing.
Pokemon made me gay, the cat story.
I made a lot of friends, and it was a fraught time in my life. And I had a lot of conversations with them where I was staying up until, like, 3 in the morning, you know, talking about, like, identity and all that. And, like, that helped me solidify a lot of things. And it also made me interested in anime and Japanese media, which got me into Japanese class, which resulted in me meeting my partner that I'm still with today. So I think back to Pokemon, I'm like, wow, man, well, things would have been very different if I hadn't gotten Pokemon for Christmas. But the moment that I was hooked on Pokemon was I picked my Charmander and I go out into the world and everything and we fight some monsters and I come back and Professor Oak says, Charmander really seems to like you. And I was like, oh, at that moment, I was like, wow, Charmander likes me. We're buddies. We're going into the world. And the thing that was beautiful about the original Pokemon was I didn't know anything about this world. And there are all these unique and interesting monsters to be found. And so, like, I went into my first gym with Brock, and he sends out Onyx, who looks absolutely enormous on this screen. And I'm like, holy cow, and Charmander's not doing any damage to this thing. Like, there was so much to discover in this game.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not often that I've had that experience with games, especially now, where it felt like I was truly journeying into a whole wide world.
To build off of that, like, when I was playing, when my son and I started playing Sword a few weeks ago, or when he started actively playing, and he gets to the wild area, and the first thing you see in the big wild area is this gigantic Onyx walking around, and he's just like, Papa, what is that? And I'm like, that is the moment. And I think that callback to the first game was very deliberate, because Onyx being like, you know, takes up the whole screen, and it's just like, such an odd, especially since at that point, by the time you're in that first gym, your Pokemon is still like in its first form. It's still kind of this puny little thing waddling. And you're like, there's no way Bulbasaur can handle this gigantic, like, you know, skyscraper sized worm made out of rocks. And I don't know. It's just, it was.
But isn't Bulbasaur like uniquely suited to take care of Onyx being grass type versus rock?
Who would know?
Can
I rant for 10 seconds about the worst part about Pokemon right now?
Please go.
Sorry. You're absolutely right, though. But that also irks me about
I was Pokemon. Being that guy. I apologize.
Why is there a rock type and a ground type? Why? Why do they have to be separate? Why is there a flying... I mean, the typing of Pokemon is... A, it's genius because it gives you a very rock, paper, scissors kind of balance of how to fight combat, how to do things. But it makes no goddamn sense, especially once you get deeper into the series and there's like 38 types or whatever. And they've got this giant cross matrix of like, of course, my steel type is weak to fairy type. Why wouldn't it be?
The ground type stops electricity and the rock type doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Unless you're Pikachu aiming for the horn. With Rhydon, in which case You can defeat ground types with electricity.
Yeah, but it's just...
Pikachu can do whatever it wants.
Yeah.
It's a weird, though, like, the initial choice of fire, water, or plant. I mean, I get it from, like, a primary colors perspective of, you know, like, when you look at kabuki artwork in Japanese, like, cultural associations with color, red, blue, and green are kind of the first three colors you would get to. But in terms of just, like, elements or, like, you know, base level, I guess, you know, natural primal forces, fire, water, makes sense. Plant.
I think Casey has opinions here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, we kind of were introduced to that kind of, like, elemental power with, you know, like Captain Planet, right?
Yes.
Earth,
that's exactly
fire,
what I was going to say.
Wind, water,
and
heart.
Yeah, but what does heart do? Nothing.
That's fairy type.
Hey.
No, come on. He could talk to his friends.
I would pick heart.
That's very important.
Empathy with the animals so that I could send them against my enemies?
Yeah, but you know what the writers of Captain Planet did? Not that. Matisse sat around and go like, hey guys, remember me?
Well, what I'm curious is, I think that the Pokemon you pick first says a lot about you. So, Casey, what was the first Pokemon you picked?
I chose Charmander. I actually chose Pokemon Red because I thought Charizard looked so cool.
There you go. Jeremy, you didn't really play. You played the original Pokemon, right?
Yeah, I don't remember which Pokemon I picked in Generation 1. I bought Blue.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember which I picked. But I do know that with Generation 4, I went straight for Piplup. Because, god damn, that is the cutest little
so
penguin.
Cute little penguin. So cute.
But then I changed my mind. That was with the import version that I covered for 1UP. Then when it came to the US, I was like, Piplup is cute, but I've got to go with the little turtle guy.
Mm.
So I named him Slamphibian. that was a high point for me because I went to a Nintendo event and they were demoing Pokemon Stadium or Coliseum. And they were like, oh, if you've got, you know, your DS with you, you can bring your Pokemon into that. And I loaded my Slamphibian, the Torterra, into the game. And one of the Treehouse dudes was there and was like, damn, we got to hire you. That's great. I was like, yes, I've arrived. Finally. Finally, someone appreciates my talents.
That's a great name.
But yeah, I'm always grass type, even though I don't smoke grass. It's weird.
I chose Charmander because I'm basic and I love dragons. I've always loved dragons. He's a fire-breathing dragon. How can you go wrong? But, I mean, I've picked, like, I vacillate between all of them depending on which, like, I mean, in Sword I picked Grookey because I want big hammer, like, plant monkey. But Blaziken's my boy and I loved Greninja, so I've gone the whole gamut.
So I'm an Infernape stan, so I have natural resentment toward Blaziken,
Blaziken is so good, he's a super Saiyan.
Everybody I knew either picked Charmander or Squirtle. And I think a lot of people picked Squirtle because of the anime, the Squirtle Squad episodes where Squirtle wore the sunglasses.
Yeah.
Which was a lasting legacy of Squirtle. Everybody loved it. So there were the Blastoise people, which was my friend, and there were the Charizard people, and then some people also picked Bulbasaur, I guess, but...
Bulbasaur is hella good, and just
Bulbasaur.
Never got any love.
Bulbasaur has grown into a real gangster. People love Bulbasaur now, like, all three of the OGs.
Yeah, but I love, like...
They're practically... You wouldn't know this when starting out, but you accidentally kind of chose your starting difficulty by the...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pokemon that you chose, even though I don't think Bulbasaur and Squirtle learned any moves that were super effective versus ground or rock types until level 13, I think is when like Bulbasaur learned Vine Whip, which was kind of a little bit over leveled against Brock, but it was possible. But anyway, so you got Squirtle that's good against the first gym and like isn't very good against the second. You have Bulbasaur who's great against the first two, and then Charmander that just sucks against the first two gyms.
Especially Misty, when you're fighting Starmie with your Charmander or Charmeleon by this time.
Oh my god, you
absolute
get wrecked.
Nightmare. You're getting, like, you just come to dread seeing that bubble beam coming out as you go.
It just gotta, would light, I mean, it made sense because, like, hit the fire on his tail is getting put out, and you're like, no!
So let me reel this back in a little bit. We're talking
what
a lot
about
like game okay. play.
Let's talk
without
back from
really
the beginning.
Explaining mechanics and typing and stuff.
So I can do that. The general gameplay loop of Pokemon is you choose your starter Pokemon from three Pokemon that a professor gives you. That same professor gives you a Pokedex so you can keep track of the Pokemon that you see and capture out in the wild. Your goal is to travel whatever region you're in, defeat the eight gym leaders, catch Pokemon as you see them, and to defeat the Elite Four, who are the most powerful Pokemon trainers in that region. And the way that you do that is by traveling from city to city and the areas in between them to capture Pokemon and level them up and train them. And as they level up, they learn new abilities. They eventually, some of them have the ability to evolve, and then they are able to learn more different attacks. Each Pokemon can only learn four attacks at one time, or know four attacks at one time. And there are 15 in Gen 1, there are, I think, how many do we start with? 15 different types, each with their own weaknesses and resistances. So you would have to choose your Pokemon based on what you're up against for the best strategy and most efficient way to fight. I think that's about it. There's a lot more to it, but I think that's the most
basic
summary of Pokemon.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that you control a kid, a boy or a girl.
Yes. Who's 10?
Who's a Pokemon trainer.
No, you do not control a girl.
Oh, and the first
the girl does not appear until Pokemon Crystal.
God.
It was just a boy.
So
trust
sexist.
Me, I was very cognizant of this.
Okay, my apologies. I just assumed that they were always enlightened. Okay.
No.
Crystal came up and I lost my mind.
Exactly,
Casey. The little lad you control.
Ash Ketchum.
Is not...
Oh, no, he was named Red?
Yeah, he was named Red or Blue, depending on which Pokemon game you had.
He is not a direct participant in battles, except to throw items out, which is not a free action. But you, like your kid that you control him for exploration. But then during battles, he's just basically calling out commands and saying, okay, animal minion, go attack.
I think they really did that well in Smash Brothers when they put the Pokemon Master. And it's just like your monster's out there and the Pokemon Master is in the background just kind of pointing and directing Puppet Master.
One of my favorite characters, even though he's not very good.
It's really creepy to me to have that like kind of idea of the slave master driving his minions to fight for.
Only if you think
no,
those
they're
terms.
Your friends.
They're your
I have
buddies.
An ethical problem with gigantic cockfighting, but I'm not going to get into that. We're talking about Pokemon. But the thing is, the game itself, being a bare-bones, simplistic RPG, you are allowed one action a turn. You're either allowed an attack, of which when you click your attack, you've got your four choices. And they did that is one of the most clever mechanics in the game, by the way. You have four active attacks that you can choose from. When you level up and gain a new power, you have to make a choice about which of these four powers are you going to punt to replace with this cool new thing you got. And that is one of the most deep and complex strategic decisions in a game, frankly.
And you can't go back.
You can't. Not until like...
not until Gen 2, I don't think.
Yeah, like once you make that choice, if you're getting rid of Leer, you're getting rid of Leer forever.
All the people who put cut on their frickin' Charmander, like me.
I did that too.
R.I.P. And yeah. Like the thing is, you get that and you've got spell slots. And so each of these powers you have has like... X amount of uses before you have to go back to a Pokemon Center to heal. The Pokemon Center being, of course, the inn that's free that heals up all your Pokemon, gives you back your spell slots. And you can either use an item, which is like a potion to heal or resurrect or, you know, whatever. You can throw a Pokeball, which once the person is weak enough that you've been... The idea is that you want to nail the enemy hard enough down so that their life is into, like... the lower third of their bar, then throw a ball at them, which has a percentage chance of catching them and adding them to your team, or missing and you feel sad about the ball you just wasted. You can fight them all the way down to knock them out. I'm sorry, faint them, because this is a child's game. You don't kill animals. You just club them until
they
pass
dead.
And and then
only if you play Nuzlocke.
Just look at Blue's Raticate. Definitely dead.
Definitely dead. You can switch to one of the Pokemon on your backbenches. So if you find yourself in a fight against something that's out-typed you or your Pokemon is getting into the red zone, you can pull it back and send a new Pokemon to the front.
And that's a key mechanic, Shivam. And I think an advanced technique that not a lot of people were really thinking about at the time, because people would get mad when I would switch out, I'd be like, oh, you're sending out, you know, your electric type. Well, here comes Golem going to block your Thunderbolt. And they're like, stop doing that. And then you start getting into predictions. He's like, no, actually, I'm going to send out Golem. Just kidding. I'm sending out Articuno. Take that. And so you start getting to situations where you're doing mind games.
And you can juke them and tough it.
He's like, you think I'm going to switch, but actually I'm going to shoot you with Ice Beam and take out your switch.
But it's also worth noting that the switch process takes a turn. So
that's why it's kind of pivotal.
Yeah, you kind of leave yourself vulnerable for that turn because basically the enemy gets a free attack.
Yeah.
So maybe you're moving in an enemy that is super effective against who they have fielded, but you know, they also pretty much get a free attack against you while you're positioning yourself.
Which is why it's also sometimes strategic to just let your Pokemon get killed so you get that free switch in. And I think that was may have been why people let their Pokemon die when fighting the NPCs, at least, because that was sometimes just the better strat.
And I'm sure your friend is really happy to hear that you feel that way about them. Actually, I'm just going to let you die because it's a better strategy for me.
Just take the hit. Just pass out. Fine, I'll take you to the Pokemon Center after this. It's not a Nuzlocke. It's fine.
In terms of the typing, in the original Pokemon Red and Blue, Psychic was preeminent. It was basically there was nothing that could take out Psychic because Ghosts only had Lick. Ghost was only the real Ghost was type was the only one that could really deal with Psychic. And so Pokemon like Alakazam were just extremely freaking strong.
Well, yeah, and the only ghost-type Pokemon in Gen 1 were Ghastly, Haunter, and Gengar, and they were also poison-type, making them weak to psychic abilities as well.
And Alakazam was so fast!
Very fast, and also one of the highest special stats in the game as well. And then the only other thing that was super effective against psychic was Bug. And we all know Bug Pokemon, I'm sorry, you're just not that good.
Bug Pokemon became much better in later generations, but the moves that they needed, like Mega Horn and such,
They
did not exist. You only had like Fury Attack.
Leech Life.
Yeah, very weak attacks. So Psychic and Dragon, I would say, kind of ruled the roost.
What was Dragon type in first gen?
I mean, it was Dragonite.
Yeah, right. That was it. And the thing with that as well, so the only Dragon-type Pokemon that existed was four times weak to Ice, because it was also Flying-type.
Also, why is Charizard not a Dragon-type?
Yeah, that's really confusing.
Don't ask me.
Because that would be overpowered to make a starter Pokemon a Dragon-type.
It's a dragon!
I know, I don't like it either. I'm just explaining.
No, dragons are thunder lizards. He's a fire lizard.
Oh, for God's sake.
Totally different. He's a salamander.
Casey, refresh my memory. The way weaknesses worked was different at that time too, right?
I don't think so, but I could
be
wrong. I mean, it's been a very long time.
Okay. Yeah, there were a number of ways that mechanics were different in Pokemon Red and Blue. And we were already talking about the base stats were quite different. Hyper Beam, a move that would not be good at all in later generations, was quite good in the original Pokemon Red and Blue, in part because it was bugged. So if you did it right, you could basically spam Hyper Beams every single turn, if I recall correctly.
So there were changes, like they did change some of the weaknesses and some of the resistances and strengths, but it was still a half it was a resistant or times two if it was strong. But there are some things different.
The reason I was asking was because I'm thinking about dual types and how like certain types could cover from one another. And my recollection was that it like changed somewhat how like which types took priority in later generations. But I might be wrong on that front.
Mentioned the word dual, and I think something important that we have not really discussed is the importance of the dual versions. We've talked about how Pokemon Red and Green, and in America, Red and Blue, And that wasn't just like, hey, you get it to collect a different color shell. No, it was like there were actual substantial differences in each game, most significant of which was that each game had its own unique set of Pokemon. There were some Pokemon that were exclusive to each game. And people, there was a lot of negativity when that was first revealed. People were like, are they trying to rip us off by giving us a partial game? Do they want us to buy both games? How dare they? But that wasn't the idea. The idea was that
it was to foster trading.
You were going to go out and you were going to have friends who owned the game, and they were going to, you know, by just the rules, the laws of odds, were going to have a different version than you, some of them. And they were going to have Pokemon that you couldn't get, and you were going to have Pokemon they couldn't get. And so to complete your Pokedex, which was realistically an objective back when there were only 151 Pokemon, you were going to trade with them. And it really was a very kind of subtle and clever, not subtle, but
there was nothing like, subtle about it.
I mean, not so much subtle, but
it forced like, the issue of social interaction, and it really drove home the point that Pokemon was meant to be a game that was not just a one-player silo RPG, but a game that you played with other people in groups, in person, because obviously the link cable, we have to be sitting next to each other to do this. It incentivized social interaction beyond just the game itself in order to get your Pokedex, and the fact that you and your friends would strategize like, okay, I'm picking up blue. Are you going to get red so that we can make sure? And that's continued.
Or people would buy both.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're now, maybe, but like when we were kids, that was less of a.
Sure.
Like,
it was diabolical, being able to get.
But I mean, it was great for people who had, say, siblings who both wanted to own Pokemon. And, you know, each of them, of course, would have their own Game Boy because a Game Boy was sort of a personal system. So this was a way to say, well, you know, you can have blue, you can have red, and oh, guess what? Now you can play together.
Yeah.
Something to do on those long car trips.
Yeah.
Assuming you had like a, you know, a Light Boy.
And like a lot of battery.
Yeah.
I hated it and loved it. I mean, I respect it because you're right. It does incentivize people buying both copies. It incentivizes you to get your friends to buy copies that you can trade with. It also, it's cool to see that you've got these individual Pokemon that show up in this one, but not in that one. I can't say like X or Y for generic, and now X and Y are actual games, so I can't use them as like generic N and M. Like
A things. And B.
Yeah, A and B, right? Like, it's cool that I can get Solrock in this one, but not Luna, whatever, that one. But it's also super annoying when you're like, I just need one Pokemon and you won't trade it to me, and just like, I haven't caught it, or I've only got one, or whatever.
Yeah, I actually realized I had made a mistake by choosing red because very quickly Meowth and Vulpix became two of my favorite Pokemon. And you,
yeah, they were in blue. It was Arcanine in red.
Yeah, because you have to have the puppy versus the kitty. But it just—it's like it was such a genius design choice in a way to make this world team even bigger. That oh, these Pokemon only show up in this half, and then you could also get a lot of playground rumors going around like, oh man, did you see that? That guy's got that amazing Pokemon. And you're like, I've been playing the game. I don't see that Pokemon anywhere. What are you even talking about? Mm-hmm. Or when you're fighting against somebody you don't know, and they pull out a Pokemon you've never seen before, and it's like, holy crap, I don't know how to fight this thing. I've never seen it. It's not in my game. And it's, there's a sense of discovery that comes with like early level CCGs and stuff where you're sitting there and you don't have all the information and you're playing and the person flips over a card and you're like, I've never seen this. I don't know how to react to it. And that was mirrored in Pokemon so perfectly. And it just, it was annoying that now in this era where like, I can't have two Switches, right? Like that's a little much for me.
Speak for yourself. I've got three.
Okay, look, not all of us are like, you know, high-level editors, okay? Not anymore. But it still makes sense in the sense of, like, incentivizing interaction. Mm-hmm. And it does a really, really good job of that.
Yeah. Shivam, I'm really glad you brought up the playground rumors kind of thing. And maybe Casey can speak to this more clearly because she was on those playgrounds. But I think
yeah, if I was on a playground in junior high school, it was junior of high school, it was maybe a little different playground.
Right.
Maybe Pokemon Red and Blue were the last vestige of the quote-unquote playground culture of, like, swapping secrets. And, like, did you hear about that? And did you know that you can get a Mew? It's somewhere in the game. Last... Here are all the things that you go through.
Missing no.
The last of the big games before wikis existed.
Yeah.
What before was your game take? Facts, even.
What was your take on that, Casey?
So I was actually, I was trying to remember this before I came on the show because I distinctly remember Missing No and M and the whole rumor of Mew being under the truck in the area before SSN.
Oh yes, that one.
Yeah, you have to teach strength to a Machamp specifically and go there at a certain time of day. Then I don't know.
It makes sense because kittens like to sleep under trucks, under vehicles.
Yeah, but I have no idea how this got to any of us. Like, how did the glitch of exactly how to do the Missing No glitch to duplicate your six item and to catch certain Pokemon, like, how, because that method is quite convoluted. I mean, you have to first get to Cinnabar Island, you have to know Fly, you have to go talk to the old man who teaches you how to catch Pokemon, sit through the tutorial, and then fly back to Cinnabar Island, and then it will pull in your encounter table from the last grass patch you were in if you go on the right side of the island and you surf. But, like, how did we learn? How did I learn that?
So I know
I wasn't
world,
on the internet.
The world has moved on, and we don't remember that these existed, but there were game magazines back in the day. And they had tips and tricks sections where they would share this information. And also, there were magazines dedicated entirely just to cheats. And there were definitely magazines dedicated just to Pokemon strategies and cheats and things like that. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, probably one or two people in your, like, peripheral to your social group picked up, and then that information spread.
Probably a fifth grader.
Yeah,
some
right.
Fifth grader one of the had cool magazines.
Kids. One of the big kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the big kids whose parents let him buy a GamePro.
Yeah. One of the big kids passed it down to us, because at the time, like, none of the people in my immediate social circle had gaming magazines. Like, we did not look at gaming magazines for another couple of years. It was always the older kids. Like, I didn't ask for my first gaming magazine until I think I was 10 or 11.
Mm.
But when I was 7 or 8, I wasn't interested.
Also, Pokemon's genius is that the language in it is so easy for children to understand and get mm-hmm. into. Like, the game is very simple, and you don't need to follow the story very much, but, like, you can understand, like, this is super effective. I know what those words mean.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, they're only in hiragana and katakana. They do not have any kanji because it is meant for young,
like,
children.
Children.
Yep.
That's really clever.
Mm-hmm. And also people like me who at the time could read hiragana, but not so much kanji.
Pokemon actually taught me a couple of words. Like, I remember asking my mom what evasion meant.
Oh. Mm.
Video couple games of are things great. Here and there.
Despite what people say, video games are great for literacy, especially RPGs. If you are young and play RPGs, you will learn a lot of grammar.
And a lot of medieval weaponry. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You will learn what a cudgel is.
And a bellicose. A glaive guisarme.
Right. An arbalite or arbalest.
Arbalife. Yeah, like, I don't know. This game had, like, it was mechanically very deep for the fact that it is literally just hit attack a bunch and, like, you know, hope that your Caterpie can get through.
But, you know, we did mention that Pokemon was pretty glitchy and rough when it first came out in Japan.
Yeah.
And barely more than half a year later, Game Freak basically put out the equivalent of a patch in the form of Pokemon Blue, which initially was only released as a prize from KoroKoro magazine.
Is that different from our Pokemon Blue?
It was the basis of our Pokemon Blue, actually. And actually, it was kind of the basis of our Pokemon Red, because it included a lot of fixes, a new script. They overhauled battle sprites and Pokemon designs, overhauled a lot of map designs, smoothed over a lot of bugs switched around the mix of Pokemon that were available in each version, and just did a lot of kind of fine tuning and tweaking. And it's really interesting because it was released in October 1996 in Japan, but only as a prize, and then wouldn't actually get to retail in Japan until October 1999.
Whoa.
So it was after Pokemon Yellow and after the American versions had come out.
When was the second Pokemon, or the Pokemon sequel, come out?
The
Gold, Silver?
Silver and Gold?
That was 2000.
Yeah, that was in 2000.
Geez, really that late?
Yep.
Yep. But I mean, you know, they kept things alive. It took a while for Pokemon to really catch on in Japan. It's not like it immediately launched a huge success. It launched a modest sales, but word of mouth was so good and people were just playing it together that it snowballed. And then, you know, once it hit the U.S., it had been through already one level of revisions, and it was refined even more for the U.S. And then Pokemon Yellow came out, and that brought in more revisions and refinements. And even the Japanese and American versions of that were different because Pokemon Yellow launched like a month before Game Boy Color in Japan, and then about 6 months after Game Boy Color in the U.S. So for the U.S. version, they added a lot of Game Boy Color enhancements that were not available in the Japanese version.
And Pokemon Yellow is interesting because, to my knowledge, it is the only Pokemon game overtly based on the anime.
Right? Like, there were, like, Pikachu is so popular, you can't get Pikachu in the base game until way, way late. And so we're going to let you have Pikachu from the start, because I'm sure people were watching the anime and they would go get the game and they'd be like, I don't get to pick Pikachu. What the hell is this? And that was a weird, I think it made sense from a marketing perspective to put Pikachu there, but it was weird that the game
wouldn't. And they put Jesse and James in there as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, because Jesse and James are like great. Mm-hmm. They're great. Team
great
Rocket
villains.
Is still one of the best, like, just bad guy teams in video games. But I don't know, like, was Yellow the one where Pikachu would also follow you around?
Yes.
That was the first time. Yeah.
That was an innovation that was so cool.
You could interact with it, and its facial expressions would, like, pop up on the screen and stuff.
That's so good. It's such a smart design to do that.
It was also really emblematic of where Nintendo was as a company at the time, because it was a mega hit on the Game Boy. It was a defining hit on the Game Boy, but that success did not necessarily translate over to console. We got Pokemon Stadium, of course, but and Nintendo released a Pokemon-themed N64 Pikachu version and everything, and I was playing Pokemon Stadium and Pokemon Stadium 2 as well, but Pokemon for the longest time was the handheld game until, honestly, until Sword and Shield came out.
Yeah, until Sword and Shield, it literally was just like, you play the DS, like whatever the Nintendo Portable is, has a Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
They're like one in one core.
It was the killer app. Like, people were like, oh, the PSP is going to destroy Nintendo. I'm like, not as long as Nintendo has Pokemon.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and every time it seems like, oh, Pokemon, you know, it's a fad, it's faded. The next generation comes out and breaks sales records. And just how it's going to be.
I think the existence of Sword and Shield is where I realized that Nintendo wasn't doing handheld anymore. That's when I was like, oh, they've moved this to the main console.
It's truly...
It is dead.
Except the Switch is a handheld, so...
Not in my house, because I'm not going to let my son drag that thing around. He'll break it.
But, you know, there's always Switch Lite.
Fair.
But anyway.
Yeah, Gold... I mean, Yellow was such a... We were real grumpy when Yellow came out. Because it's like, already, I have to buy Red and Blue, and now you're going to make me get Yellow to get the Pikachu?
You don't have to buy it. It's okay, Sheep.
It wasn't mandatory.
In 11th grade, I wasn't going to buy it. I was going to ask my mom to buy it, and she was going to say no. And that's just how my life was. But yeah, it was just like, it was weird, because it came out, and it was just an expansion pack. And we were not used to expansion packs on games.
It wasn't even really an expansion pack. It was just kind of a remix.
Yeah, it's like a repackaged version.
I mean, have you ever played Street Fighter, Shiba? I know you have.
Look, Cat.
But in this one, you could play as Vega also. It's totally different.
They remixed the colors.
Shut your mouth.
Casey, did you play Pokemon Yellow?
Yeah, I actually got it at launch, and the only reason I realized how special that was is because I was playing it in a doctor's office waiting room, and some older kid was like, "Whoa, you're playing Pokemon Yellow? You're so lucky. I wasn't able to get it." Ooh. I had no idea.
You were one of my grandma, cool kids, Casey.
No, my grandma was a baller, and somehow, like, she also helped me procure a Wii pre-order.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I don't know, just magic. But so yeah, I also played Yellow, and I'm realizing now that these being some of my first experiences with games, I think has colored the way I expect games to be released. I think I'm a lot more forgiving about games being so similar to previous iterations, because some of my first big games that I was really into as a kid was Pokemon Red, Blue, and Yellow, and then Pokemon Ocarina of Time. Pokemon Ocarina of Time, The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, and then Majora's Mask. And those were kind of my big formative games that I played. Mm-hmm. And they were very, I mean, Majora's Mask is extremely different from Ocarina of Time, but all of the assets are exactly the same.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm used to a generation where Super Mario 1 and Super Mario 2 don't look like they came from the same century, let alone same time period or game.
The thing that's surprising to me is, okay, so the original Pokemon came out and it was dated already in 1998, very dated, and yet it holds up. It is still very fun to play today. When it came out on the 3DS, I was like, I don't have any reason to play this. Like, the games themselves have moved on. You know, Red and Blue, Gold and Silver aren't even strictly compatible with the current games. I mean, they are now, but...
Wait, it's on the 3DS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Virtual console.
They actually keep all of the glitches and everything, too, so you can still do the missing no trick.
The reason they put them on Red and 3DS, finally, they had been holding off for so long putting these games on systems was because they couldn't connect them adequately, and they were always going to be like, this isn't just a ROM dump, this is going to be part of the Pokemon ecosystem, which, good on them, but I could not believe how fun the original Pokemon Red still was. Years and years later, it holds up as a basic RPG, and Game Center CX did a series where they caught all of them and in the original Pokemon Green on the 3DS, and it's the most enjoyable thing I've watched in a long time. Those games are timeless.
You know, ultimately, graphics are not as important as gameplay, and Pokemon really proves that. And that's why we do Retronauts. Yeah. Anyway, we are out of time, so believe it or not...
But I haven't been able to tell you about the Elite Four and
the great thing is that there's Japanese still so culture. Much more to say about Pokemon Generation 1 stuff, including the spin-off games, that we'll have to do another one of these episodes.
Yeah. I just want to real quick say I'm so glad how much Pokemon has evolved, because I've been going back and playing Pokemon Platinum, and man, grinding in those games sucks.
Yeah.
It's so slow and terrible. So
doing EV training in Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire, nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is, what I was saying earlier about how people eventually come back around to Pokemon, I just dug deep and bought a copy of Pokemon Platinum for my nephew, who's like 19. Because that's what he wants for Christmas, is the game that he played when he was, you know, 8. He's like, I want to go back and play that again. I'm like, kid, do you know how expensive that game is now? All right. That's what you're getting for Christmas.
Yeah, but your Uncle
that's
Retro
your extravagant
games.
Gift.
It's your brand.
But he doesn't, like, you know, he's interested in kind of the current Pokemon games, but he really wants to go back, specifically the Platinum. And, you know, there is this profound nostalgia, and despite the frustrations and you know, some of the dated elements and things that have been refined, like, there is a powerful allure to these games, and, you know, a definite sense of timelessness that makes it easy to go back to them. And even as someone who you know, kind of came into Pokemon and was like, at first, like, I can still see that appeal.
For me, it's such a joy to watch my own son sit there and go through the same kind of story beats and emotional, like, highs and lows of a Pokemon game. The first time your party wipes because you typed wrong. The first time you triumph over a gym leader and you're like, yeah, I did it. It's timeless. Every kid goes through this. It always feels good to, like, sit and feel like you accomplished something. And the feedback loop in Pokemon is so perfect. The fact that you always feel like you're learning, that you're growing, that there's another challenge to beat. And when you beat it, you feel like the king of the world. And no game has done it better.
No, and it even has an awesome built-in gacha mechanic and finding new Pokemon in every new area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for talking about Pokemon Generation 1 for the first time. We're going to have the Pokemon Yellow version of this podcast at some point and revisit it, I guess. Talk about stuff like Hey You Pikachu and Pokemon Snap and Pokemon Stadium and so on and so forth. But for now, that's it for Pokemon Generation 1. So thank you, Kat, Shivam, and especially Casey, newcomer. Appreciate all of you taking the time to share your memories and experiences and thoughts. And wow, there is just so much to say about this series. It's really remarkable. But anyway, this has been Retronauts. And as always, you can find Retronauts at retronauts.com and on all kinds of places on the internet. But most importantly, you can support the show by going to patreon.com/retronauts, because we are crowdfunded and this podcast happens because of your support. So $3 a month gets you early access to each episode at a high bitrate quality with no promotions or ads. But $5 a month also gets you 2 monthly exclusive episodes for patrons only, as well as mini podcasts every weekend by Diamond Fight, and finally, Discord access. So check that out at patreon.com/retronauts for infinite hours of retro gaming delight. Casey, what do you want to hype for yourself for the internet to find you and follow you?
Oh man, so you can find me at Twitter at ShinyKCD, and you can also find me on Twitch at ShinyKCD. I'm actually currently doing a Platinum Nuzlocke run, and I've been putting up summaries of those Nuzlocke runs on YouTube as well, so you can catch up really easily and not have to watch 2.5 hours long streams to get caught up. So yeah, check me out. I'll be on Twitter.
Nuzlocke. I do a podcast about Magic the Gathering called Casual Magic. You can find it everywhere podcasts are sold. On Tuesdays, there's a new episode. And you can find me on Twitter at Electrotal, where I sit and talk about religion and politics a lot.
Kat Bailey.
You can find me on Twitter at @the_catbot. My podcast is Axe of the Blood God, an RPG podcast that's kind of in the Retronauts expanded universe, I guess you could say. We're on Patreon at patreon.com/bloodgodpod, and my day job is over at IGN, where I'm a regular over on Nintendo Voice Chat.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at GameSpite on Twitter as Jeremy Parrish on YouTube, believe it or not. You can find me doing stuff at limitedrungames.com. Wow, that's a mouthful. And you can find me here on Retronauts, talking about Pokemon. And that's it for this episode. I think it's time to go catch them all. Mm-hmm.